I'm Lindsay Zarniak.
And I'm Lolo Jones. Coming up on Her Turf at the Olympics.
We'll be talking to Wyomi Tyus, the first athlete to win back-to-back Olympic gold medals in the 100 meter. Also, a conversation with beach volleyball player Carrie Walsh Jennings.
This podcast is presented by Nordatrack from iFit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to On Her Turf at the Olympics. I'm Lindsay Zarniak. We have so much to get to today, but first, I am so pumped for week two of these Tokyo Olympics. A familiar face will be joining me to co-host this show. It's Lolo Jones. Lolo, welcome to the On Her Turf family. We're so excited.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Okay, so first off, you are coming off of, well, you're in the middle of team trials for bobsled for the Beijing Olympics that will be in February. You've written a book. You've got like five different shows you're a part of. Like, what is it like to be in your shoes right now?
In my shoes, it's hectic right now, but we're making it work. I'm so excited for my last Olympic push for bobsled. This is it. A girl is getting old and she is ready to be done. And okay. I'm just fired up. We're just out in Lake Placid and we are in the beginning stages of making the team for USA and then on to the Olympic team. So I know the Olympics are next year for us, but we are in the thick of it now.
So describe what that is like when you're there in the midst of it.
Oh, it's a competitive, fiery, intense environment, but like the girls are thriving. It's a situation where we're pushing each other to get better every day. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like, okay, I run really fast and another person tries to outdo me, daps, and it's amazing.
Okay, so you were going to make a push for the Summer Olympics. What happened?
The pandemic. It shut mm-hmm. everything down. So I had just run my first race and things were going good. We were on track and then lost races, competitions, then couldn't even train at facilities because all facilities closed. And so I was just like everybody else around the world, sitting in my house. I didn't see another human for a month and a mm-hmm. half and I had no clue if I was retired or not. I had no clue if the Olympics were going to be canceled, postponed. Everything was completely shut down.
So you decide to go for bobsled again. What do you have to do to your body? Because you were in basically running shape,
I was
right?
In running shape. So that conversation with the coach, he's like, look, you know, so I lost track season, was completely canceled pretty much. We had no races. And the bobsled coach is like, it's fall now. He's like, we're having competitions. I'd love to have you come back out and try out. And I just started gaining weight. 30 pounds.
You have to gain 30 pounds. How do you do it?
It's like trying to morph your body from wide receiver to a linebacker. So, you know, wide receivers are really fast.
Sure.
Linebackers have to be big and solid because they're defending and they have to push. And that bobsled is 365 pounds.
Yeah.
So I just had to gain weight by, you know, eating a ton, which was fun at points.
And sure, then,
you
sure,
know,
sure.
And increasing my power by lifting a lot of protein shakes, but I'm not going to lie, I had some wings there along the way.
Okay, I was going to say, what's the one thing that you eat that does it fast? Anything that's...
I'm definitely having a lot of wings, burgers, you know, but I am eating, like, there are days where I'm eating quite healthy. So it's not all just splurge.
No, very good. I kid, sort of, but yes, this is... Okay, we're so excited to have you here. Check this out. We're going to turn right now to water polo. American women's water polo player, Maggie Steffens, widely regarded as one of the greatest players to ever play the game. On Friday in Tokyo, she made history.
Dump it off. Wonderful look inside. And that is how Maggie Steffens becomes the all-time leading scorer in women's water polo at the Olympics.
Maggie Steffens makes Olympic herstory with a broken nose. Did you believe that? It was during a game last week against China that the break happened. And with blood, Lolo, streaming down her face, Steffens was forced to twice leave the pool to receive treatment. Then after yesterday's record-breaking game against the Russians, Steffens was asked what the record means to her.
It's really cool. I think, you know, as women and as our team, we're constantly trying to see how we can propel the sport forward and propel each other forward. And at the end of the day, the only way to score goals is to get an assist and to have a team. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my teammates. And so as much as it's really cool to have that, at the end of the day, I wouldn't have that without my teammates. I wouldn't have that if it weren't for this team. So I could play 0 minutes and score zero goals, have zero assists, like individual stats at the end of the day don't matter as long as we win, as long as we're successful as a team.
Speaking of team and support, we also love this quote from Jordan Rainey. Rainey was actually the last player cut from the United States Women's Olympic water polo team. She wrote about that experience over on the On Her Turf blog. She said, quote, success is putting yourself on the line, challenging yourself to be the best. Turning now to tennis, you've got to see this, where the Brazilian doubles team made some history of their own.
That's out. It's a storybook bronze for Brazil.
Oh my goodness, the Brazilian team of Luisa Stefani and Laura Pagosi, they faced four match points. They didn't even know their coach had put them on a waiting list and entered the competition just 1 hour before the cutoff. Incredible. They win Brazil's first Olympic medal in tennis. We also have an important update relating to women's soccer. Last week, players on the U.S. women's national team filed an appeal requesting that their equal pay case be sent back to the district court. Last May, a judge threw out the players' arguments that they were systemically underpaid. Yesterday, the Players Association that represents the U.S. men's soccer team filed an amicus brief, which shows the court it supports the U.S. women's national team. But the brief filed by the men goes a step further than supporting equal pay, saying instead that the U.S. women's national team deserves better pay, given their record of international success. The brief saying in part, quote, rather than rewarding the women's efforts and success with equal compensation, the Federation has spent more than three decades treating the women as an afterthought. Wow. Lolo, what are your thoughts on that?
Wow, that's powerful. The afterthought thing, oh, that hits my heart because I remember the hate that the women's team received when they actually were going out fighting for equal pay. And, you know, women were like, well, their ratings and compared to viewership. So the fact that the men are acknowledging that and saying like, no, they are being treated as an afterthought is very powerful.
Cool to hear them speaking out. On Her Turf at the Olympics, we'll be right back after this. With track and field getting up to speed, the women's 100-meter final saw a Jamaican sweep. Elaine Thompson-Herah, who's dealt with numerous injuries since claiming Olympic gold 5 years ago in Rio. Look at her go, successfully defending her title, breaking Florence Griffith Joyner's Olympic record from 1988. Yes, in the lane beside her, it was Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce winning silver. Listen to this.
Wow, look at the celebration. I'm getting choked up watching
really?
That. Yes,
wow,
absolutely.
What does it make you think?
Well, it's just so hard to win the Olympics. And not only that, win it back to back with a 5-year delay. This was an incredible feat for her to do. The emotions you can see are raw, they're real. It's amazing.
It's just so cool to hear that scream, right?
But she did so much in that race. Broke the Olympic record, Flojo's record. I mean, this is incredible. Defended her title. Just
at what point does she realize all that?
She realized it when she crossed the line and her hand is already in the air looking. She crossed the line. Her hand is already. Sorry.
Now you're going to make me cry. Stop. All right. With her win today, Thompson-Herah became just the fourth woman to win back-to-back titles in the 100 meter. Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce previously completed that feat in 2008 and 2012. And before her, it was Gail Deaver successfully defending her 1992 title in 1996. But you may not be familiar with the very first woman who won back-to-back titles in the women's 100 meter. It's a name and a story you should know.
We remember the 1968 Mexico City Olympics for this iconic image. Track and field stars Tommy Smith and John Carlos famously protested racial injustices on the medal podium just 6 months after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Smith and Carlos were expelled from the Olympics for their demonstration. But there's another athlete, a two-time Olympian, in fact, who also used her platform in her own quiet way. Wyomi Tyus is a name we should all know. After winning gold in the 100-meter sprint in the 1964 Tokyo Games, she went on to make history defending her title 4 years later in Mexico City.
Wyoming Atias has defended successfully her gold medal that she won in Tokyo 4 years ago.
Atias became the first woman or man to ever win back-to-back gold medals in the 100-meter sprint. Before there was Carl Lewis or Usain Bolt, there was Wyoming Atias. And not only did she make history on the track, but she made a statement while doing so. Atias wore dark blue shorts, while her U.S. teammates sported the all-white uniforms. It was her way of raising her fist and using her platform. And decades later, Atias continues to advocate for Black athletes to speak up. More and more are indeed using their voices on the biggest stage in the world until we hear their message. Because let's face it, it's time for change.
We're so excited to now be joined by the legend herself, Wyoming Atias. Thank you so much for joining us on the turf at the Olympics, Wyoming. First of all, I have to ask you about your name, because we've realized that people have been mispronouncing it, saying Wyoming, since the 60s. How's that happen?
I don't know, because when you correct them, they still keep saying to me, oh, it's an A on the end, so you have to pronounce the A because that's the English way. And I said, well, I grew up in the South, and not every vowel will say you pronounce. So no matter how many times I would try to explain to them, it's Wyoming, and that's what, you know, I just got tired of seeing it. But now we got it on record, it's correct.
Okay, Wyoming. Yes. Can you take us back to 1968, your involvement with the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the kinds of conversations that were going on in that lead up to the Games?
It was a lot of unrest happening all over the world, not just in America. And when we were going to the Games, saying we were going to go to the Games in 68. First, they said they were going to boycott the Games, and then it got to be, well, my whole take on that was that you can't boycott it unless you make the team. So if you don't make the team, you won't be boycotted. But it got to be the Human Rights Project. And I got involved because, my involvement was very limited because, as I've said over the times, we as women were not even consulted or talked about. It was always assumed that we were just going to go along with whatever the men say. And being a Tiger Belt from Tennessee State, there was seven women from Tennessee State that was on the track team that made the Olympic team in 68. So my involvement was that I knew I grew up in the South, and I grew up during the Jim Crow era. So I was always exposed to a lot of racism and a lot of things, and also being a woman, a Black woman, and the fact that, hey, girls are not supposed to do this. Girls are supposed to do certain things in that. But my father and my mom always said I could do whatever I wanted to do. And so I always look at it as I've been an activist from age 5 or 6 when I was fight to play with my brothers and all those things. So when 68 came around, it was no problem for me to say, hey, I am for human rights. I am for standing up for your rights. And but no one was asking me. No one was talking to me about it. And my silent, I didn't ever think of it as a silent protest. I thought, well, this is who I am and what I want to show. And I wore my Black shorts. And I didn't wear them the first day, believe it or not, because I didn't know how I wanted to protest or let people know where I was or how I felt about the Human Rights Projects. Well, so that the first race I didn't wear them, and then this afternoon when we ran the trials, I wore them then.
Wyoming, do you feel with your silent protest, do you think that it led to any change?
I think it's leading to change now. I think a lot of people are seeing what's happening, what I did, and I think people, young women especially, are saying, hey, we could do this, or I could do this. I should feel strong enough, and I am strong enough to stand for whatever rights I want or whatever, stand for me. And you, when you're doing this, you're not doing it for the world, you're doing it for yourself. You're doing it so you can help improve the world or help improve race relations.
And that's what I love so much about your protest, is not only that you protested, but you followed it up with the lifelong of action and a mission. So tell us about that. Like, did that just continue to propel forward? Like the conversations, the just inspiring other athletes?
It didn't continue. I mean, I had a lot of different jobs. I did a lot of different things, but nobody really was writing about it. And you also have to think about how much coverage was given to women. I think now we see coverage forever and ever. And, you know, it can't go without, we would not have Tokyo without women. And then when I was in Tokyo in 64, no one was, you know, very few people, even just going to track meets at our Olympic trials. Only people who were in the stands were your parents or the teams and, you know, things like that. You didn't have it like it is now. So it was silent in that way. But, you know, my protest was more, I mean, I got kind of confused there. But 68, it was more about me and what can I do when I leave track and field. And then when I came to Los Angeles in 68, I got involved with different things. And I got involved with the Women's Sports Foundation. Matter of fact, I'm one of the founding members of the Women's Sports Foundation. And how that came about was that we were at a Women's Superstars and we were all talking about it. And we found out that all of us had the same, some of the same things that we were we wanted to address. And one of them was that women did not get enough publicity. The other one was that when we would talk to young people or talk to parents, the mothers would say to us, you know, when I was running, no one encouraged me. I didn't have anybody to look up to. And we felt that there should be a change here. How could we change that? So we came up with the Women's Sports Foundation.
Which is incredible. Yeah. That's, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I personally have received a grant from the Women's Sports Foundation. So that is an active, yes, it's an active thing that currently helps female athletes to this day. So the fact that you're a co-founder, that is an amazing accomplishment. I have to ask you though, with the, when you did the protest, obviously there wasn't social media back in 68. There wasn't, you said you weren't getting a lot of attention. It was more so on the men's. Did you receive any backlash for your silent protest?
I don't think anybody even recognized it. I always say wearing those blue black shorts only came popular now because people now are looking at that and realize that was a protest. But no, it was like, I mean, I won back that in 68. I have won 100 again. I was the first person ever to win back-to-back 100 meters, and they still didn't cover it. So that lets you know how much coverage they were doing for women.
I want to ask you.
I mean, we went into the press room, and I can just remember going into the, after running the relay in 68, and we go into the press room, and they're talking to us, and all they want to talk to us about is what happened with John and Tommy and all those things. Nobody really, our relay team had set a world record, all these things, and nobody was really concerned about us as women.
You both have something else in common. You have both successfully defended something. You've defended a title, you, what we've seen in Wyoming, and then you in hurdles, right, at the Worlds.
Correct.
How difficult is it to do that? I would love to hear that from both of you.
I mean, I was only at a world championship level. I can't even fathom the Olympic pressure to defend your title. It's hard enough to win just the Olympics, let alone do it back to back. So she's going to have to just give us tips on that.
Yeah, Wyoming, what was that like, that part of it?
You know, you don't really think about it. For me, I had two goals in mind in 1968. The first one was to graduate from college, which I did in August of 68, and then to go to the Olympics and win the gold medal in 100 meters. And those were my goals. And when I went there, I mean, the pressure for me, I guess, because I've been in the Olympic Games, also because I was on a great team at Tennessee State, the Tiger Bells, and I had a wonderful coach that really coached not just me, but all of us. And hey, you can't win them all, and you have to be happy and satisfied with what you do. And also he had a model, because Wilma Rudolph was before me, and she went to Tennessee State. So we had models, and we had all the women on the 1968 relay team, 4x100, from Tennessee State. So we had them talking to us, grooming us, telling us, keeping us calm, so to speak. And it's unlike this day and time, so much pressure on your athletes and all the commercial, you know, endorsements and all those kinds of things. So you got to kind of take time for yourself, and it's very difficult. And I think we're now seeing that. That's what's happening with a lot of people, with a lot of athletes, and they're coming out and saying, I said, this pressure is too much. And I used to say to reporters all the time when they would ask me, so are you worried about this pressure? I said, I don't worry about my competition. I let my competition worry about me. So those kinds of things got me through.
Wow. That's powerful.
It is. I wonder what kinds of things are the same. Like when you said winning one is tough, but defending is a whole different ballgame. What did you mean? Why? Why is that?
Well, because they put the pressure on you to, you know, they announce it. It's like the defending world champion, the defending Olympic, you know, so it's an extra pressure, and you're already out of pressure filled competition. So I love what she said. She removed that pressure from herself, and she just focusing on execution and then her goals at hand. And so that's why she's, you know, multiple Olympic champion. I mean, just volumes right there.
Wyomi, before we say goodbye, what is something, a lasting legacy, if you will, that you really hope you are able to instill in today's society?
Well, I wrote a book about 2 years ago. It's called Tiger Bells, and it really tells my story and the things that I would like to leave about it. I'm going to show so everybody can see that, you know, you can go out and buy this and see this. And the thing for me is, like, when I was growing up and as a child and playing with my brothers and just playing, doing anything, our key things, my brother and I, what we would always say to each other, you have to stay in the fight. And what staying in the fight is, you just got to be there. You got to, you know, and that doesn't mean it's a physical fight, but if it comes to that, but you know, but you have to just stay in the fight. And if you stay in the fight, I think you will be satisfied with what you are. And I think that's the other part. You have to be comfortable with what you do. And as my coach used to tell us all the time, everybody's not going to get on that victory stand. Everybody's not going to win a gold medal. But, you know, everybody can contribute. And whatever you contribute to the sport or to yourself, you have to be very happy with that.
Wow. You said two things, coach and your teammates. And I think that's so cool, just the amount of support that both of you have really talked about, which is awesome. Wyomi Tyus, thank you so much for joining us. More from On Her Turf at the Olympics after this. Are you ready for a flashback to last night? Katie Ledecky in the 800 meter. Ledecky becoming the fourth swimmer and first American woman to win the same event three times at the Olympics. She also breaks the record for most individual gold medals won by a female swimmer, an amazing accomplishment for Ledecky. And we are now joined by four-time Olympic medalist in beach volleyball, Carrie Walsh Jennings. Thanks so much for coming back.
My pleasure. I'm shocked I'm back. I love it.
This is going to be so much fun. First of all, I want to get your all's reactions to what Katie did and what you guys watched.
Three times. Yeah. Three times? That is so insane. I mean, you have to fill us in.
No, same. It's insane what she's doing. You know, to me, like, that just shows it's such a labor of love. She loves what she's doing. Otherwise, she would have quit after her first time, you know, but she feels like there's more inside of her and that drives her. And hell, I want to see her go for four.
But as a multiple Olympic medal winning athlete, does that pressure continue to build, or does it like give you confidence to just keep just knocking down these races and competitions?
You know, I think generally everything is momentum, right? And everything, like wherever your attention goes, that's where your energy flows. And so I have to believe that Katie has so much self-confidence because she's done it. Her history proves she's capable. And then she probably has bouts of like, do I want this? Am I good enough? But that probably lasts a split second. And then she gets to work. So I think it's all confidence and momentum and positive energy.
And so it sounds like it's kind of like the momentum changes, right? With each one. Is that true?
Well, do you feel like you're manic sometimes? Well, with all due respect, I don't know if that's the wrong term, but like up and down and
absolutely.
Confident. And then, oh my God, what am I doing?
But I love that you said that about momentum, because one of my favorite quotes is momentum builds momentum. And I think that especially if you just get, like, if you make your first Olympic team, then it's easier for you to make your next one. If you get your first Olympic medal, it's easier because you've been there and you know how to accomplish it, and you can just use those past experiences to continue to build. And I think that that's what she's showing she's doing.
100%. And then also, like, thoughts are momentum, right? So if you're in a funk, literally stop. What am I thinking about? What are my thoughts right now? And you'll realize you're going momentum in the wrong direction. You could stop and pivot and then just choose better thoughts. You know, and that's part of being a champion. you've been doing this for so long. I've been doing this for so long. You have it in your career. Mm-hmm. Like the thoughts we choose are so important. You know, sometimes we think our thoughts choose themselves, but they don't. We're in charge.
Right. So you mean you guys both have bouts of ups and downs and not
Absolutely.
Feeling confident.
Yeah. I love it when they're like, do you ever get this question? Like, when's the moment that you knew you were talented enough to make an Olympic team? And I'm like, I still don't know. Sometimes I'm like, serious on Olympian. I'm like, I don't know. It's like, today.
It's insane. But you know, there was a Mia Hamm quote, and I'm not even going to try to quote, but she was just like, the best of the best have that insecurity. They have whatever that driving force is pushing them to more. And I think a little bit of that voice is insecurity. You know, like, yeah. I want to belong here. I want to prove to myself above all. But I think that's an important part of greatness. You know, don't live in that space, but let it provoke you to greatness.
I've never thought about it that way. That's so interesting. We were discussing before something we need you to answer. Where do you keep your medals?
I can't even think of where they are right now.
But really? You know that most of your teammates, what do they say? Sock drawer?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. They're in the closet somewhere. They're in a drawer. Because we only bring them out to like when you do an appearance, mm-hmm. you get to show little kids, or most people have never seen one.
So you don't know where they're at?
They're, you know, they're in Aloha collection bag, which is my favorite bags to travel in. I know it's in a bag. I just, no idea.
All together. Like I don't have an Olympic medal, but if I had one, it'd be like in a high vault security system with lasers and like a camera, like motion sensors going off.
Well, you just need to wear it constantly. I can't wait. Well, that's coming for you.
Mine would actually be like in a frame like that, you know, the on her turf thing over there. Like it would be pretty.
Well, you can't put it in a frame because then you have to take it out for appearances.
This is
shadow box.
Shadow box, exactly. Okay, so this, we haven't had a chance yet to talk about the gap between the Olympics, which I think is so interesting because mm-hmm. the fact that we're coming off of Tokyo, we will go into Beijing in February, right? You have the experience of summer and winter Olympics, you and summer. What challenges come with that?
Yeah, Carrie. I mean, I personally think that they're dealing with something that they've never dealt with before with, you know, back-to-back Olympic Games. Normally, they wouldn't even have the Olympics airing right now. Like right now, I'm just leaving the Olympic Training Center and we're having our first round of kind of Olympic qualifiers. But the Olympics are playing, so those that adrenaline, the emotions are kind of like, it's creeping up. So what do you think about that?
Well, I just think it is what it is. You know, it's new for everybody, so you just have to make the best of it. You know, you probably could give us the best anecdotes ever, you know, because you're in the thick of it working to qualify and yet where all the attention should be on you, right? And that love and support that usually we get to feel the qualifying process, it's all on the Summer Games.
Absolutely.
So it's a new mental challenge and probably an emotional challenge for you. What I've learned in these games is that the crowd energy is so important. You know, there's something so missing in these games and it's the athletes miss it and you can tell. So, but what I love is that the teams are doing great, the athletes are doing great. It's self-source. It's coming from within. And you talk about athletes and they're always inspired from the inside. The outside is a bonus. So, but the outside helps, you know? So what you're going through, I mean, I just think you're a warrior. All the athletes are just going through it.
Thank you. Well, I have to ask you this. So I'm in the Olympic Training Center and there's athletes that will not watch the Summer Olympics currently going on right now because it's frying out their nerves.
Yeah.
You know, you only have so much central nervous attention before your games.
Sure.
So if you were, you know, in their shoes, would you be watching the Olympic Games if you were currently having to qualify for the Olympic Games, but the Olympics are airing right now? Would you not watch the Olympics to kind of try to keep your zen and your peace? Or would you?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to try it. You know, I think I would try it because once I do something, I'm like, oh, either it's either a yes or it's a no. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think our nervous system, what you're saying is so important. Like there's so much input into us every single day and we give so much. And so if something is not inspiring you, I would turn that sucker off.
Oh, it's inspiring them too much.
Oh,
so they're seeing people
so they're
on the podium. They're seeing them win those medals, but then they're trying to actually make the team. And so it's like,
It's getting them too hyped.
It's getting them too nervous. And this is from a person who's won 3 Olympic medals and they're like, you know, I see them on the podium and I'm fighting back tears because I know what that feels like, or I'm seeing them win. And I have that, you know, those moments where I'm just like, I need to keep calm.
Yeah.
I'm still in the fight. I'm not on the team yet. I have to qualify.
Right.
So they're not watching the Olympic Games to keep their central nervous calm.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because they're two different beasts, right? The qualifying process is gnarly. And that's what prepares you to do great at the Olympics. So if you're feeling too frazzled or too amped as you're going through that process, I mean, it's just a personal decision. Mm-hmm. I run high as is. I talk fast. I'm always hot. Mm-hmm. I'm ready. And so maybe that would be too much for me. But I also know that seeing other people do well and seeing that it's possible and seeing that people are fallible and they're still human mm-hmm. and still loved, like that whole process for me is really important to recognize. So personal choice, mama.
Carrie, you said the qualification is gnarly. Like, what? Why? What did you mean? What's that like for someone who's never been through that process?
Well, A, it's 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone sees the Olympic Games as 2 weeks out of every four-year cycle, but it is a lifetime getting there. And this year coming around was 5 years for the summer and the Winter Olympics. Olympians, that's like gnarly, you know, because most of the athletes don't make a lot of money. They have to have other jobs to subsidize their income. They have to pay for their own coaching, pay for their own travel. You know, America, the USOC is not funded by our government. And so that's why we rely so much upon our sponsors. And we're so grateful for the Olympic sponsors and the personal sponsors that we have. But the qualifying process is like the fortification process. It's the initiation. And if you survive it, in my mind, then you just get to go play because you already did the hard part. Then you get to go play and let your skills be on display.
Let's talk a little bit about the sponsorships. So with the Olympics being back-to-back, those major sponsors had to sponsor Summer Olympians pretty much a whole nother year, which mm-hmm. would cut into their budgets for Winter Olympians. Yeah. Now, if you're a Winter Olympian and you need that funding to basically survive, to have treatment, to have coaches, to have physio, what's the effect on that? Like, if it's going to be harder for those Winter Olympians to get those coveted sponsorships because now it's a priority for Summer Games.
Oh, 100%. And like, I live off my sponsorships. I do not live off prize money. I don't know many athletes, unless you're on salary like the NBA or tennis or whatever, that you're, you know, living off your prize money. And so I think you probably have the most interesting perspective, you know, because those sponsorships that are going to the Summer Games are, you know, could be yours and should be yours.
Absolutely. I mean, we share the same marketing agent and he told me, he was just very honest with me. He said straight up that it's going to be very hard for Winter Olympians to get sponsorships this year. So he just kept it very 100% with me to just lower my expectations. And, you know, so which I knew automatically that would affect how much I could pay for massages and treatments and, you know, to budget accordingly.
To budget it out. Right. That's fascinating though. What other kinds of things do you think could be affected like the sponsorships? You were saying training?
Training. We have training protocols. Oh, currently at the Olympic Training Center, the Summer and Winter Olympians share medical staff. Well, that half of that medical staff is currently in Tokyo helping the current athletes prepare for the races. So those that are qualifying for the Winter Olympics now have half staffed. It's not, you know, it's and they wouldn't normally have that. Normally the Summer Olympics would be over. And they would be the priority right now. Right. Their attention would be on them. So I'm curious to see if there's going to be increased injuries on the winter side, because if you have less physios, chiropractors, they're all right now in Tokyo. I mean, I've personally seen it right now. There were so many medical waivers for Team USA bobsled trials. I've never seen so many more medical waivers because we have a few less people at the Olympic Training Center working on athletes.
That's not unlike what we saw even last year in the NFL, just to compare it to something, because in training camp, there were a significant increase in injuries because of that very reason, just because of the pandemic experience. But I would love to ask you both about sports psychology and how much that plays into what you do, you know, as athletes, as Olympians, and just how important that really is. Is it something that to be on this stage, you have to be dialed in with that and really make it a practice or no?
I think 100%. I think if you're not training your brain, then you're missing out. You know, there's so much leverage in this part of our body and it literally rules the rest of ourselves. So if you can develop self-awareness, if you have a mindfulness practice, like for me, I have my performance psychologist, Mike Gervais, and he helped me get rid of so much baggage and insecurity and shame that I was carrying that I didn't really know I was carrying. And that allowed me to perform more freely. You know, and then I have more awareness around my breath. And when I'm in a funk, I have trained myself to stop, be like, what are your thoughts doing? What are you feeling? Okay, breathe. Okay, choose a better thought, whatever these things are. So I think sports performance training is essential. I wish all these little kids could have it because there's so much stress. We're so inundated with stress these days, you know? And anything we can do to self-source our calm and our protocols to help us live a more stable life, I'm just a big fan of.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I personally know I've won races just by my mental state alone when my physicality was not up to par.
How?
Meditations, you know, talking to someone, whether it's with a team or, like she said, sports psychiatrist. So significantly have improved competitions.
Well, how often do you feel great when you go into a competition?
Never.
Right. Exactly.
It's very rare.
So it's just, there's so much, and it's so emotional. You know, there's so many highs and lows, physically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, you know. So just, I have a trainer for every area of my life. So if I'm leaving the most powerful thing that I have in me up to chance, that's just silly. you know, and I'm so happy that mental awareness is being talked about and that it's not taboo anymore. That to me, it's like, it's such a sign of strength to say, I need some help here. You know, mm-hmm. I need some guidance here, you know, because you have excellence right. I want to tap into. I want to know how to get the best out of myself. And that's just been a game changer.
Well, that's, as you say that, I'm thinking about the image that I was looking at and I was so curious about was Suni Lee getting ready to do her performance on the beam. And they were doing this commentary, the announcers were, about her in the moment and how she had said that she felt like she was going to throw up after the fact. They were reflecting and showing that video. And every time I watch a gymnast, I'm like, I want to know, okay, what are they thinking right now? They look so nervous. But that is a great question. Like, what are you feeling when you are right about to start what it is you're doing, whether it's a volleyball match, whether it's bobsled, or, you know, before you cross that line to start your race? Is it... How do you feel? Like, do you feel, do you have to get to a baseline of, I know I'm like rambling, but I just, like I'm this, so interested, like right?
Like, let's go.
Yeah, you know, I don't even know what my thought process is in that moment. Like, I'm just kind of feeling things. I'm trying to connect with my partner. I'm trying to stay calm and breathe. But like, I want that fire. I want that energy.
Of course,
it's always the in-between time. That's the worst,
it's
right?
It's the in-between. Ugh. It's the night before, the morning of, where you're just like, oh, I feel like I'm going to throw up. But like, when you're on the start line, when you're on the sand, I think for me, when I'm on the start line, it feels like the eye of a storm. You know, like everything's swirling around you. The crowd is loud, the TV, the camera, all that. But you are in the middle of it. And there's a very, there's almost like a calm. Like if you've prepared, you are like ready to attack. You're ready. You're in the moment. But it's the weird times where the nerves hit you. It's like the night before, or, you know, watching clips of people winning. You're like,
So have you found things to help you with that? Or like, do you have routines that you do? Or do you have a pre-match, pre-race routine?
You have to do it before you get there. Like you can't show up and like, hey, now I'm going to work on being calm and being the eye of the storm. Like you have to practice
it's years,
with that.
And years, for sure. Like journaling helps, you know, your team, and you have someone else you have to work with, which is, that's a whole, like I'm learning that with bobsled, a whole nother person to navigate their emotions on top of your emotions. Like in track, it's just you, but you know, vibing off
which
of
seems
your,
so lonely to me.
Gosh,
I could never be a solo athlete. Like never.
Really?
I'm not tough enough. No. I like playing off people. That's my thing. But it totally is a different, it's a dance.
Mm-hmm. It is.
You know, and it's in every which way. And the best teams dance well together.
The teams are great though. I had, when me and Kaylee won Worlds this year, there was a moment where like maybe I was like faltering a little bit with my mental state and she looked at me dead in the eyes like a tiger and was like, let's do this. I was like, oh my, like it just snaps you. It just snaps you. Like, someone else is relying on you. Like, let's go.
So, well, that shows trust. I love that. That she, you were able to be like, I see you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I trust you. Let's go.
Wow. You said something earlier that made me think about younger, like girls, women that are looking up to you guys, you know, to try and to emulate what you guys do. Are there things that you think about that if you were looking back, you would tell your younger self?
So many.
You would? I feel like I would say nothing to my younger self.
Really?
Because I don't want to like, you know, I needed those failures. I needed those
100%.
L's. I needed to know that I wasn't good enough, because not knowing that I wasn't good enough is what drove me every day to do the extra abs, the extra workouts, to eat healthy, to stay diligent. If someone's like, you know, like, okay, coming back, it's going to be tough. I just feel like oh, you're telling me I'm going to be an Olympic athlete? Maybe I wouldn't have done the extra stuff, you know?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I would never tell them the outcome. I mean, if I were to tell my younger self what I'd have to go through to do what I've done, there's no way in hell. Like, excuse my language. There's no way I would have retired. I mean, even, I don't even know what's coming up next year and I'm worried about my bones and my tendons.
Right.
And you know, you go through all these things, but it serves you. And what I would tell my younger self is it's worth it. You know, and I would say, don't be so hard on yourself. Expect great things. Work for greatness. Know you're going to fail, but don't hate yourself when you fall short. Because to me, when I feel a lot of shame when I don't perform well. And shame is a very heavy, heavy thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, that's something that I would want to cut the edge of when I talk to my children. I don't want them to feel ashamed if they fall short, if they fall flat in their face. When they go through hard stuff, I'm literally like, this is here to serve you. Like, I'm excited for you. You know, this is going to toughen you up.
Legit make you stronger.
This is a rep.
Yeah.
This is a rep at, you know, mental toughness of looking in the mirror saying, I got what it takes. You know, and then physically, all that stuff's important too.
Yes. Thank you so much, Carrie, for being back, Lolo. Your all's perspective is just so cool to hear. That's it for today. But be sure to follow at On Her Turf on Instagram and Twitter. Also, you can find conversations like this one we're having on our podcast. Just download the On Her Turf podcast on Apple Podcasts. For Lolo Jones and Carrie Walsh Jennings, I'm Lindsay Zarniak. We'll see you tomorrow.
This podcast is presented by NordicTrack from iFit.